In the dairy world, and specifically for milk fat, our big difference is in palmitic acid versus 18-carbon fatty acids, because most of what the cow is absorbing from the diet is stearic acid, because most of the unsaturated fatty acids in the diet are hydrogenated in the rumen. So we see the most consistent fat responses to palmitic acid.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Kemin invites you to optimize animal feed quality and safety with our portfolio of solutions. Learn more at kemin.com/AG. Evonik, we are sciencing the global food challenge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of the Feed Science Podcast Show, brought to you by Wisenetics. I am Wilmer Pacheco, and I am an associate professor in the Department of Poultry Science at Auburn University. We are dedicated to bringing you the latest insights and discussions in the feed industry. Get ready to expand your knowledge and stay ahead with today's episodes. And today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Kevin Harbentin, professor of nutritional physiology in the Department of Animal Science at Penn State. Dr. Harbentin's research focuses on ruminant nutrition with emphasis on how diet management influence cow's health, milk composition, and overall production. His work has provided important insights into feeding strategies, fat supplementations, and their role in animal agriculture. Hello, Kevin. How are you doing?
Great. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being with us, Kevin. And first, could you please share some insights of your professional experience with our audience? What sparked your interest in ruminant nutrition and led you to specialize on cow's physiology?
Great. So I guess it really starts out that I grew up on a small dairy farm in Northeast Pennsylvania, and really have to give credit to the 4-H program. It was interested in a lot of livestock projects showing steers and sheep and pigs, and that really caught my interest. Came to Penn State and did my bachelor's, went on to Michigan State to do my master's. That was more focused on what I call traditional nutrition, so rumen, intestinal digestibility, and then wanted to get molecular biology experience. So I went to Cornell for my PhD and then a short postdoc. Working with Dale Bauman, and now I've been back here at Penn State for 16 years.
Excellent, excellent. I have never had the pleasure to visit, but it must be like a good place to live there.
Yeah, it is. It is a beautiful place, and we have all the benefits of a college town, and we're in the middle of the state with a lot of hiking and in scenic areas around. It's really nice place.
Excellent. Excellent. And, you know, like during this podcast, I would like to focus a lot and, you know, like pick your brain on, you know, like milk fats. And maybe, you know, like the first question that I will have is like, what has changed about how we think about feeding for milk fat over time? And maybe what are the biggest lessons we have learned from the last past decades of research?
Yeah, so when I started out doing milk fat work, really a lot of what we focused on for many, many years was just diet-induced milk fat depression. Mm-hmm. And there's a good reason there. We had a lot of problems with acidosis when we were feeding too high starch diets. When distiller grains became available, they were really high risk for milk fat depression. And we commonly saw a lot of really low milk fats from milk fat depression. And then in that early 2000s period, there's a flurry of research that we actually understood what was causing the problem, right? So it was really neat that we understood a mechanism and we could have an impact in the real world. But when I started on faculty, I remember talking to a lot of nutritionists, and they're like, you know, you researchers are really good at decreasing milk fat. That's not what we're trying to do in the real world. We're trying to increase milk fat, right? So I'd say over the past 15 years, that's really been a lot of what our focus has shifted from is the how do we stay away from milk fat depression, which is still really important, to this how do we increase milk fat? And I'd say a lot of our perspective kind of have this long-term goal to actually be able to predict and understand why each cow or each herd has a certain level of milk fat, and then go beyond that to say, okay, this is why they are at the milk fat they're at. What can we do to actually increase their milk fat? So on the nutrition side, a lot of our focus is in the last dozen years has been around increasing fat supplements and specific fat supplements to improve milk fat. We've done a series of experiments around acetate, which the cow normally gets her acetate from fiber digestibility, but we were able to supplement acetate. And both of those are looking at what I call a substrate mechanism. So you're providing more of what the cow needs to make milk fat. So I'd say that's the big change, is that our entire focus is milk fat depression to our modern focus of staying away from milk fat depression, but at the same time trying to improve milk fat.
Excellent. And does milk fat change over the year? So maybe because you are discussing like there are some nutritional, you know, depending on what you feed, you can influence the amount of milk fat. Or are there any environmental drivers that also influence that?
Yeah, definitely a bunch of different environmental drivers. And season is a really big one. And, you know, everybody had lived this every single year, that we had low milk fat in July, and then milk fat would increase in the fall, and we'd have highest milk fat in January. And, you know, all the nutritionists thought they were doing a great job, and then all of a sudden, milk fat was going back down when we went through the spring. So we had always lived that. And I think we used to try to explain, at least during the summer, as it being heat stress. And a number of years ago in the lab, we were also doing some circadian rhythm work, so daily patterns. And to do that, you have to fit a cosine function. So we had worked out the approach to be able to fit cosine functions in our mixed models. And we said, hey, why don't we use that same approach to try to quantify these seasonal rhythms? So we went in a couple different databases and have characterized that seasonal pattern of milk composition and milk yield. And it's really amazing. It fits that cosine function almost perfectly. So you have highest milk fat January 1, lowest milk fat July 1, really consistent every single year. And what I like to tell people is, you know, to sit down once a year, pull out your calendar and write on your calendar what you expect your milk fat to be each month, because I think we can more accurately and precisely know if we're reaching our goals in our potential for our herd, if we're accounting for that pattern. Now, that's most likely being driven by lengthening and shortening days and the change in day length. So there's not a lot we can do about managing out of that, but we can at least program that in. And it's about 0.3 units, maybe a little bit more than that, change from the high point to the low point across the year.
Okay. And that's really interesting. So do you have like any colleagues, like let's say in New Zealand or Chile, that they see the opposite?
Yeah. So when we first did the data, we used our U.S. milk market data, and then we used data from DHIA, the DRMS database. And everybody asked, well, what about South America? And it's like, I really don't know where to go to get the database, but there's some folks in Brazil have done a really good job taking some databases from Brazil and show the exact opposite thing that we see. So it's a really, really consistent pattern that way. I hear from nutritionists in Australia and other parts of the world that they know it's happening similar just from what changes they have. But the only other analysis I know of is from Brazil.
Okay. And maybe, you know, like, because it seems like that milk fat is predictable based on the time of the year. So are there any strategies that, you know, like nutritionists or, you know, other people working in the industry, they can do just to minimize, you know, like, let's say that reduction in milk fat that you're going to observe in July 1st, for example?
Yeah. And, you know, there was a lot of day length work done actually going all the way back to the 80s. And that data is really consistent that if you put cows under constant long days, so it's 18 hours of light, those cows make about 5% more milk and they don't change milk composition. So the best recommendation as far as like managing the environment standpoint I have is to try to have constant long days, but you do need a dark period, because if you do not have that dark period, you lose the effect. The other thing that's really interesting is that a lot of that change is you get more of a change in the de novo synthesized fatty acids. So the fatty acids the mammary gland's making from scratch. So if you think nutritionally, that cow actually needs more acetate and more glucose to keep up to that potential. So we haven't done any experiments to do this, but I think it kind of is logical to think that if there's a time of year where you would want to be feeding good quality forages and making sure rumen fermentation is really optimal, you would want to be doing that through the winter period, just so that you're not cutting off that potential for the highest milk fat. Now, I hate to say that because I don't want everybody to leave their really bad forages during the summer. We want good forages year round. And I think there's a good argument for the good forages would have a benefit for really during heat stress periods also.
And you know, like when you were discussing about the length of the day, do you know like if there is any difference between the type of light or this the spectrum of light that will work better for, you know, to maximize fat production?
Yeah, so the circadian, this is likely all linked in with the same systems that are being triggered in the circadian rhythms. And that's within the blue spectrum of the wavelength. So that's where you would actually want to focus. And there's two parts of that. So during the day, if you were targeting in wavelengths, you'd want to hit blue. At night, if you do need some light at night, you would want to be doing reds, because that has the least effect on that circadian system.
Okay. That makes sense. And are there any fat sources or maybe like some feeding strategies more reliable than others to maximize?
Yeah, so definitely over the last 20 years, we figured out that not all fatty acids are the same. You know, the basic biologists were ahead of that in us with understanding omega-3 fatty acids and the effect that they have on liver metabolism and in inflammation, things like that. In the dairy world, and specifically for milk fat, our big difference is in palmitic acid versus 18-carbon fatty acids, because most of what the cow is absorbing from the diet is stearic acid, because most of the unsaturated fatty acids in the diet are hydrogenated in the rumen. So we see the most consistent fat responses to palmitic acid. We will see milk fat responses to 18-carbon fatty acids when we start at very low-fat diets. So there does seem to be an interaction between dietary fat level and fatty acid profile, but it's the high palms that are going to be the most consistent in that fat response.
Okay. So does that mean, and you know, like I'm in the poultry industry, does that mean that like producers, you know, from US, they need to bring like palm oil from other areas?
Most of what we're using in the dairy industry is a high palmitic acid free fatty acid product that's a byproduct of palm oil refining. So we're not using palm oil itself, but this fractionated product. But what's really changed, fat has always been an expensive nutrient, but it's gotten much more expensive the past few years. Part of that is the competition that we have for our tallow and in some of our other fat streams by the renewable fuels, biofuels segment. And then part of it also is just the way the different oil markets have gone. Ocean freight costs and those other things have also increased those costs, the dietary fat. But it's really been an interesting spot that if we think about fat just as an energy source, it's very expensive. But we're not just feeding it for an energy source now, because we do need to deliver a certain amount of dietary fat to really support milk fat production.
Okay, yeah, because we are in the same boat here with poultry too. You know, like because fat is very expensive right now, it doesn't even enter the formula. Sometimes you have to force it. We are in the same situation with expensive oil and cheaper corn. So, you know, when you're formulating the diets, it will naturally, the formulation program is going to ask for more corn and less fat.
Yeah, and it's hard to look in the crystal ball and see what the future is gonna hold on that. But it's been rather consistent in the last few years that it seems to be a reality.
And are there, because you know, like you discuss a lot like fat supplementations, are there other nutrients that also the producers need to pay attention? Maybe like let's say amino acid or rumen bypass amino acid. Does that also influence at least the level of solids in the milk?
Yeah. And actually, just to flip back, so we mentioned kind of the fat supplements themselves, but the other thing that we use quite a bit in the dairy industry is whole cottonseed, which is a good source of fat. And now there's also, we've always fed some roasted soybeans, but that had actually gone down over time. Now there's a lot of interest in feeding roasted soybeans. And I think that's going to be a future, more and more of a source of fatty acids for us. The other nutrients that really play in come in related to the risk for milk fat depression. So you need a stable rumen that has good biohydrogenation capacity. And we really don't understand a lot of about that at the really specific level. We know that we become more unstable the more starch we add, the more rapidly fermentable we make that. We know we move in the safer direction when we add more sugar to a certain limit, but there's the microbes that ferment sugar seem to be good biohydrogenators. We've also done a series of experiments with HMTBA, so the methionine analog, and that's been really consistent in our hands that the methionine analog maintains diversity of microbes in the rumen, maintains a higher protozoal population. We don't know exactly which of those microbes are the ones that are important that it maintains, but it really stabilizes fermentation and keeps it more consistent. But you know, I always say there's a lot of different ways to feed cows, and most of them work, right? There's a few of them that don't work. Anything you do to mess up the rumen, you can end up with milk fat depression. Even we'll get calls where you have a bad silage fermentation and you have really high yeast counts, and that will throw the rumen off and cause milk fat depression. We don't know exactly what it is about that, but that is, there's a lot of different factors like that.
And when you were talking about roasted soybeans, because right now there are some varieties of soybeans that are high oleic soybeans, right? When you talk about like roasting, are you referring to any kind or specifically to high oleic soybeans?
Yeah, so we've always fed some regular conventional soybean, but the problem with conventional soybeans is in the fatty acids, about 54% of it is 18-2. And that fatty acid is the highest risk for altering fermentation, causing milk fat depression. Oleic acid 18-1 is lower risk for disrupting fermentation. It's hard to compare apples to apples, but I often say that probably 18-2 is 2 to 3 times the problem that 18-1 is. So these high oleic soybeans, they've been on the market for a little while. We did some early experiments back in 2018 and 19, and there's also work done at University of Wisconsin and in another lab here at Penn State that was, it really showed what you would expect from those soybeans, that they had a lower risk for milk fat depression. Now, there's been a flurry of research over the last couple of years and a lot of interest from the field. Number of different reasons. Part of that is, like we said, fats become such an expensive nutrient. But what it is that hyaluronic soybean allows you to feed to higher levels while maintaining a lower risk for milk fat depression. So, there's pretty wide range of what people are feeding, but you definitely can probably go to, say, three times more, and maybe not every time going to be okay, but you can feed much higher levels without entering problems. I always like to comment on that they're not zero risk. There's still some risk for milk fat depression. Those soybeans are still, I think, about 12%, 18.2%, but they are much lower risk.
Okay. It's really interesting because in chickens, that's what we need. We need 18.2 linoleic acid.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting to know, like, you know, cows are completely different. And I think that's why it's so important to understand the physiology of the animals that we're feeding.
Yeah, we have done a little bit of poultry work around omega-6 and omega-3 fatty acids. And I haven't dug super deep into that, but I know there's literature on that, an essential fatty acid requirement. But boy, I think we really probably could go back and do some more work with all these fatty acids now that we understand more about what each of them does.
Yeah. So I'm going to ask you another question, and then I will ask you like the three questions that we ask to all our guests. And from your perspective, what do you think that are the biggest challenges that dairy producers face today when it comes to nutrition, and, you know, like what universities can do to support them?
Yeah, so I think our challenge always in ruminant nutrition is this balancing fermentability to maximize energy intake while still maintaining stable rumen fermentation, where we get good fiber digestion and don't have milk fat depression. I guess I hope we don't solve that problem, because I'll be out of a job. I've always thought this is so, you know, good perpetual research to do, because it is, we can't take things to extremes. We have to have a balancing act. So I think that's really our biggest challenge for the nutritionist, because as soon as they start backing off on energy, most of the times we're energy limited in milk production. But it's also a really big challenge for producers. And, you know, I would also say I think that the nutritionist and the producer, the manager, have really an equal part, because the more we learn about this, it's not just about the diet, but it's a lot about how you're managing that cow and how you influence cow behavior. So I think that's another really big thing, is to get that, not just the right diet on paper, but then to have it be working on that farm in an efficient way that works well for the cow.
Yeah. And maybe I will ask you another question in that regard, because I was curious too, because when you discuss fiber, are there like any like sweet spots between soluble or insoluble fiber? How does that play into cow's nutrition and rumen fermentation maybe?
Yeah, so I think I would go back to there's so many different ways to feed the cow. And it's really interesting when you start looking across the U.S. how different of diets people will put together, and they still work for that cow. Now, again, there's some of them that don't work for the cow, but the cow is pretty adaptable. And I think what that comes down to is regional opportunities. So if you look at folks in California that are feeding a lot of byproducts because that's their local advantage, right? And you look at their soluble fibers in sugar concentrations are really high, and their structural fiber levels are pretty low, but those diets are able to to work in that situation. But then you go to the upper Midwest and they have a lot of corn silage, and most of the fiber coming in is coming in on that corn silage. So I think we can make a lot of different diets work, and we need to do that to take advantage of those local opportunities. It's just a matter of how you pick ingredients to match, to complement the base diet.
It's time for our famous three.
WiseNetics turns podcast airtime into brand authority. We don't sell ads, we elevate voices. If you're ready to boost your authority in the industry, access WiseNetics.com and speak with a brand authority specialist. Let's transform expertise into influence. Starting now.
Okay, excellent. So now I would like to ask, the final three questions, and maybe if you could share your favorite industry-related book.
Yeah, so I'm going to have to go with Journal of Dairy Science as my modern favorite book. When I was on the Dairy Podcast, I mentioned there's a 1980s lipid metabolism in ruminant animals that I really enjoy looking back over. But I probably most of my reading is Journal of Dairy Science, and there's always really, really neat stuff coming out there.
Excellent. And outside, the academia and the scientific, landscape, what is your favorite book?
Yeah, so I'm going to have to go with 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And I think I probably need to go back and read it again. It was recommended to me back before I started graduate school. So I think I read it in the summer of 2001. And I actually give a copy of it to every one of my grad students when they start in the lab. There's a lot of modern business books in that kind of theme, but 7 Habits, I really enjoyed, and I think it's really a pioneer in thinking about how to manage and do things well.
And since you are talking about grad students, and we care a lot about students as faculty, so maybe if you could just provide some advice, to grad students that are now in in their master or PhDs, what tools can they use, while they are in the university, to leave the university better prepared to, the challenges and the opportunities that are in the industry or in the academia?
Yeah, so my mind goes to, we had a university president a number of years ago that when you're speaking to the new freshman undergrads on campus, he said that, Penn State, what he was talking about. He said campus is like buying a Ferrari, but most students never drive it over 5 miles per hour. Mm-hmm. And I think my advice for students is really to jump in and engage with everything that they have an opportunity to do, and just try to take advantage of the opportunities that they have, not just at the university they're at, but with industry and in our professional societies. There's so much out there. So many good folks are willing to give advice scientifically and professionally. Lot of opportunities there. It's just you have to jump in and take advantage of them.
Excellent. Well, that concludes another episode of the Feed Science podcast show presented by WiseNetics. Thank you for joining us today. Don't forget to subscribe to stay ahead on future episodes. And if you enjoyed today's episodes, please leave us a comment. Thank you, Dr. Kevin, and I hope everyone have a blessed day.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.